Well, first this hour, modern American intelligence took root not during World War II, as many believe, but actually in the Great War, World War I. In France, the U.S. Army flew aerial photography missions and broke the codes of the German Army. Back home, the Army, the Navy, and the Justice Department's Bureau of Investigation secured the nation against spies and saboteurs, both imaginary and real. Meanwhile, the State Department was conducting daring espionage missions abroad. Our guest today is spy historian Mark Stout. He's a former State Department and CIA intelligence analyst, and he's the director of the Johns Hopkins University's Global Security Master's Program. Mark, nice to have you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, there's a story about the downing of a Zeppelin carrying incredibly lucrative information that helped put at risk one of the greatest German threats of all time, the U-boat. Tell us about that.
Well, the Germans during World War I were pioneering the use of Zeppelins not only for reconnaissance purposes but also for bombing purposes. And they would fly missions.
These are the big balloons that sort of hover, not real fast. Yeah,
exactly. Think about blimps. And these were very dangerous missions, actually, for the Germans to fly, and in particular because the British were focusing a lot of attention on shooting them down. And on one occasion, one of these Zeppelins was shot down, and the British obtained cryptographic information that allowed them to get major insights into German code systems. Not so different conceptually. It's sort of the Zeppelin version, if you will, of the U-571 story, which was heavily fictionalized in the Hollywood movie, but based on a real incident where you grab an Enigma machine, pardon me, in World War II from a German submarine. Same sort of idea. Mm-hmm. So in World War I, as in World War II, both sides are really in an offense-defense cycle with regard to all forms of intelligence, but code-breaking not least among them. And anytime you can grab the other guy's code systems, whether it's code books or code machines, you've got a big advantage.
And what happened to the U-boats, these boats that would patrol the oceans and torpedo enemy ships, and they did it so effectively?
Yeah, during World War II, the British were able to read a lot of the German naval cipher systems, the Naval Enigma system, and were able to use that information to intercept messages to and from the U-boats as to where they were or where they were going to be at some future time, and then use that to focus the naval and air assets of both the Americans and the Brits to go finding and hunting those submarines. Similar sort of thing went on during World War I, not nearly as sophisticated, but a lot of intelligence effort went into finding German U-boats in the Atlantic during World War I as well. Less signals intelligence oriented and more oriented on human intelligence, i.e. the work of human spies. But in both of those wars, I mean, there's so many similarities between those wars, but in both of those wars, the ability of the United States and the Canadians to ship forces across to Europe, and for that matter, for the British to buy supplies, just, you know, food and weapons and that sort of thing, and bring them from North America was critical. And so there were battles for the Atlantic in both of those wars, and intelligence played a major role there.
Hey, I gather spying has a history that predates World War I by maybe centuries. Am I right about that?
Well, the old joke in the business is that espionage is the world's second oldest profession.
Is that right?
Yes, indeed. And spies, indeed, if you look at ancient texts, whether it's the Bible or texts out of ancient China, texts out of ancient India, spies show up in pretty much any political or military account of, you know, 2,000-3,000 years ago. The world's oldest, or rather the world's first battle of which we have a tactical account, like what actually happened on the battlefield, is the Battle of Kadesh in 1274 BC.
Wow.
The Egyptians versus the Assyrians. And spies played a major role in two places in that battle.
You know, Mark, of all the countries that were involved in World War I, which ones had the most advanced, you know, espionage networks?
Well, it's hard to really say definitively, but I think my money would be on the British for espionage and on the French for code and breaking and communications intercepts.
I thought for sure you'd mention the Germans.
Well, the Germans were good, but the Germans, how to put this, a lot of times had sort of lacked organization and structure, which really in a lot of ways runs sort of counter to the stereotype of Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Or of Germany, at any rate. I mean, they a lot of times also had difficulty putting their information together. So, for instance, during the period 1914 to 1917, when World War I had started, but the United States itself was neutral, we didn't enter the war until April of 17, The Germans, and also to a lesser extent the Austro-Hungarians, were engaged in widespread espionage and sabotage in the United States. And a lot of it ultimately wasn't really very effective.
I was
and
really
I think
struck
this was
by
a hallmark
that.
Of this.
Why were the Germans messing with us even before we got into the war? As you just said, we were neutral then. Why are they messing with
us?
Well,
it's a great question. And one of the reasons is that Britain and France, so Germany's enemies in this war on the continent of Europe, were acquiring a lot of their munitions and weapons and other more mundane things but necessary for war, like pack animals, here in the United States. And so the Germans were messing with those supply chains in various sorts
of
ways.
So we were supplying the Allies.
We were supplying the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the policies of the U.S. government, while technically neutral from a German perspective, and not unreasonably, I think, from their perspective, looked like they leaned very pro-Allied. And thirdly, the United States was also an area in which a lot of people who had connections to the British Empire and gripes with the British Empire lived. And so the Germans put a certain amount of effort into trying to inspire anti-British sentiment among Irish Americans, among Indian Americans, people who were, you know, arguably subjugated people of the British Empire as a sort of indirect strategic way of weakening Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of things going on here.
But the last thing the Germans would have wanted was the great bear of the United States to wake up and go to war. So you wonder how much they were risking by, again, doing the kind of damage they were doing to us.
Well, that's easy for you and me to say, and it's absolutely right. But that's one of the big failings of German intelligence, or more broadly speaking, German strategy making during World War I. Is that they really discounted the extent to which the United States could actually play a role in the war in Europe. They thought we were weaker than in fact we were, that we would be slower to mobilize and get forces over there than we were, and that we just didn't really matter. It wasn't really important, and that was one of their very worst mistakes. I mean, so much of World War I is about Germany, to my mind, making one strategic mistake after another, and that was one of the last and one of the worst.
Well, the German high command was determined to cripple U.S. capabilities, as you were saying, but not provoke the nation to enter the conflict. German undercover agents attacked railroads, warehouses, shipyards, and military installations in 1914 and 15, and then came something known as the Black Tom Pier attack in July of 1916, again, just short of a year before the U.S. enters the war. What was the Black Tom Pier episode all about?
Right. So Black Tom was the rather unusual name of an island near New York City, which was a munitions dump. Which was actually under the purview of the U.S. Navy. And on this particular occasion, there was a very large quantity of munitions there that were under contract to go to Russia, which was another of Germany's allies that the United States was selling war material to. And the Germans organized saboteurs. This wasn't actually done by German citizens themselves, but they organized saboteurs to blow this facility up, which happened. And was an enormous explosion, blew out windows miles and miles away, and really aroused public and governmental attention to the German sabotage and espionage problem in a way that a lot of these other events, which had been much more minor and much less successful in most cases, really hadn't done. And in some ways, and I don't want to go too far with this, but in some ways this event echoes on. Because the Undersecretary of the Navy, the number two guy in the Navy Department at the time, was a gentleman named Franklin Roosevelt. And remember, Black Tom had been under the purview of the U.S. Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And when World War II rolls around, he has this in mind, and there's at least some evidence to suggest that this played a little bit of a role in his thinking of, ooh, we've just gone to war against Japan in 1941 or into 1942. We need to round up the Japanese Americans so that we don't have any more Black Toms.
Ah.
Bad historical analogy,
yeah.
but there seems to have been some influence on his thinking there from what had happened back in 1916.
I should point out that Mark Stout will be discussing American espionage during World War I tonight at 6. The event actually begins at 6:30, I believe, at the Central Library branch on 10th Street in downtown Kansas City. Go to kclibrary.com for more information about that. That event tonight, 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Go to the Kansas Public Library's website for more information about that. You know, given, Mark, how common trench warfare became in World War I and how difficult it was to attempt to cross no man's land, you know, the area between the trenches, between opposing armies, I've read that it was common to rely on local citizens for information on, you know, advancing lines and how troops were being supplied. Tell us about that.
Well, that's absolutely right. If you wanted to find out what was going on behind enemy lines, going straight through the enemy lines was pretty much a non-starter. There were some experiments during World War I with flying agents over in airplanes and landing them in the enemy rear area. That never really amounted to much of anything.
Yeah.
Instead, what you'd look for was some sort of neutral country that had a shared border with Germany or with some part of occupied France or occupied Belgium that you could use then to legitimately cross that border, and now you're in the enemy rear area. Mm-hmm. So the Netherlands and Switzerland and, to a much lesser extent, Denmark became really important places through which spies could be dispatched or to which underground agent networks that you'd recruited among the civilian population could send their information. So for instance, the Allies, particularly the British and the French, but also the Americans after we entered the war, organized train watching networks. And the idea here was that you'd recruit just ordinary citizens who happened to live or work in places where they could watch train traffic go back and forth. And you could identify German military trains. And by the types of cars and the numbers of the cars, you could figure out if it was an infantry unit or a cavalry unit or an artillery unit or whatever. So they'd make note of this. Okay, so an infantry regiment went this way at noon, kind of thing. And they'd report that sort of very micro-level information back through a network that would ultimately lead to an Allied intelligence officer in the Netherlands or in wow. Denmark, who would put it all together. And you could get this macro picture of, hypothetically, the Germans seem to be moving two cores of their army from, say, the Eastern Front to the Western Front, and it's headed towards the northern part of the Western Front. So it can give you some advance warning. Mm-hmm. And the people who were doing at the pointy end of the stick of that were farmers and housewives, wow, and shopkeepers in occupied France or who'd been recruited in Germany.
And those same folks were also involved in watching the trenches sort of move and be redug, well, and everything else,
well,
or
less
not?
Less so, because the civilian population would be either moved out of or just simply flee the actually rather narrow area in which the trench warfare actually took place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were in France or Belgium in World War I, what you would see would be a very thin strip of, I don't know exactly, maybe 15 miles wide in which there was utter devastation. And then on either side of that, just by a quick glance at least, you couldn't even tell a war was going on at all.
That's amazing given the carnage, the intense carnage in the area we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. And it's quite unlike what you saw in World War II, for instance, where battlefields got, you know, enormous, not only in width, but also in depth. Mm-hmm. Here, they're very wide. The front line goes all the way from Switzerland at one end to the English Channel at the other end, but it's very narrow. And so there really aren't any civilians there. In terms of the ways that both sides kept track of what the other side was doing in terms of digging new trenches or maybe moving in artillery pieces and that sort of thing, that was primarily done by aerial reconnaissance. Started out in the early days of World War I simply with pilots looking over the side of the plane and saying what they'd seen when they landed.
Mm-hmm.
Second, slightly more sophisticated version.
Airplanes pretty new in those days,
airplanes
obviously.
Are extremely new.
This is scary stuff.
Right. It took a great deal of courage to fly at all, let alone when somebody was shooting at you.
Mm-hmm.
Airplanes in these days were, you know, made of wood and fabric. They were not much to look at. Second generation of this would be they'd take notes, or they'd have an observer, a guy in back, who'd take notes, and then you could drop the notes attached to sort of like a weight over the friendly lines. And then the third and more sophisticated version that finally started taking over was the development of aerial photography.
Mm.
And that was really the key method by which both sides kept track of the precise intricacies of the other guy's trench lines. And you can draw, I think, a straight line from the aerial photography of World War I to the more sophisticated spy planes of World War II and the early Cold War. I think that U-2 spy plane and the SR-71. And the same basic notions of aerial photography go into the operations of spy satellites and even with a bit more of a stretch, I'll admit, the drones that we see today. And it all had its roots in World War I, that, you know, we can now actually be in the air over the enemy's territory and there's relatively little he can do about it. And it gives us tremendous information.
How high would you have to be to sort of avoid whatever artillery that the bad guys would have in those
days? As a practical matter, you had to be something... you wanted to be something over 10,000 feet or so, but
you could also, you could see enough at 10,000 feet.
Oh, absolutely, and in fact, higher. But it wasn't just height that they depended on to protect themselves; they also depended on fighter planes to protect them. And the stereotypical image of a pilot in World War One is, you know, the Red Baron or Snoopy,
with the scarf flying out,
flying a fighter plane,
right,
shooting down other fighter planes. Well, the real reason that almost all of that was going on was to protect or to attack observation planes. Protect our own observation planes or attack the enemy's observation planes. Now, as we started out with talking about the Zeppelin, there was a little bit of bombing going on in World War One, but frankly, it was trivial. So, fighters would spend some effort trying to attack bombers, but that really was not a big deal. It was very minor. The real reason that fighters existed was to either protect your own observation planes or shoot down the other guy's observation planes.
Yeah. Let's go to our listeners here. If you want to join our conversation about spying in World War One with our very good guest, Mark Stout. Again, he speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library down on 10th Street in downtown Kansas City. More information, I gave out the wrong address, kclibrary.org for more information about that event tonight. And to grab a seat, just go to kclibrary.org. Our number here, 816-235-2188. Again, 816-235-2888. You know, I know we're talking about spying here, Mark. We've been talking about spy planes and trenches and all this stuff. What about, you know, good old-fashioned spy stuff like stealing documents, infiltrating meetings, and scouting out troop movements? How were those kinds of things carried out?
Well, that was a very big deal. And one of the really important developments in espionage in World War One, that it changed from a basically 19th century character to a 20th century character. And what do I mean by that is, if you look in the 19th century, spying was pretty much synonymous with scouting or with reconnaissance. You send some guy out and he looks at something, maybe with binoculars, and he comes back and he tells you what he saw.
That was the Civil War model.
Very much the Civil War model. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
But, you know, this goes back to literally ancient history. And certainly that continued in World War One. Those train watchers I talked about were doing a version of that. But also you began, because World War One is a modern war of entire nations and national systems and huge bureaucracies, both military bureaucracies and civilian bureaucracies, all struggling against each other. It became important now in ways that it really hadn't before to steal documents from inside the enemy, I'm making this up, but war ministry or foreign ministry.
How do they do that in those days?
Well, same way we do it now, and that's the critical point. This is why it's a turning point to the modern era, is you find somebody who has access to those, and you recruit them to sell you those secrets, or you find somebody who has access to somebody who has access to those documents, and you get him to sort of weasel them out of the target who doesn't even know that it's going to enemy intelligence. And this started to become more and more the flavor of espionage in World War One. So, for instance,
more of that happening than spies. I had this, you know, glamorous movie induced image of spies sort of infiltrating a building and stealing a document after hours and escaping surreptitiously.
Yeah, that's good James Bond stuff.
Yeah,
but
right,
in the real
right.
world, that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very rarely. Yeah,
darn it
would be a much more interesting world if it did.
Yeah.
But no, spying is much more about stealth. It's about not letting the other side know that anything ever happened. And, you know, contrary to popular impression, it's, you know, 95 times out of 100, it's not about taking some, just to make this up, American and having him pass for a German.
Mm-hmm.
It's about finding a German who will sell what they've got to an American or who will unwittingly leak it to an American.
Yeah. So when America, then, the U.S., Mark, gets into the war in 1917, the war is several years old at that point. To what extent were we able to compete in the spy game with Germany, France, and Britain when we get in late like we did?
Yeah, so the war had been going on about 2 years and 8 months by the time the United States entered, and really we were pretty slow to seriously get going generally, including on the intelligence front. 1917 was pretty much, I think, what they call in the sports business a rebuilding year. But by 1918, we were starting to be serious players. And by the end of the war, November 11th, 1918, the armistice, I would argue that the United States was, while not as good as the British or the French, it was entirely comparable to the British and the French. We had learned very, very, very quickly. We were only in the war about 20 months. And we went from near zero, highly unsophisticated, let's say that, to almost state-of-the-art in that period. And it was, I think, two things going on. One is that because we were falling in alongside the British and the French, it was in their enlightened self-interest to teach us.
Yes, help us along.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the other is that, you know, war concentrates the mind. You got to find the right answer, and there's a high motivation for finding the right answer, and feedback on what doesn't work is immediate. And I think that was the other thing that really allowed us to evolve very, very quickly to be near world standard by the time the war was over.
How did you get interested in spying in World War One? What was it about it that intrigued you so much?
Well, I'm a former intelligence officer myself,
yes,
so I've been interested in intelligence for a long time. And when I was in the intelligence business as an analyst, I was working on military affairs, so that's two-thirds of it. As far as World War One, when I entered the PhD program, I did my studies at the University of Leeds in the UK. I was looking around. You're always looking around as a graduate student for something that nobody else has done. And somebody
said,
lo and behold, right. It's stunning. So a great deal has been written about British intelligence in World War One, and pretty good amount, particularly in French and German, on the French and British intelligence in World War One. There's almost nothing written about American intelligence in World War One. World War II, you can fill shelves and shelves in bookstores or libraries about World War II American intelligence. Almost nothing about World War One, and so that's just wonderful from the point of view of somebody working on a PhD dissertation.
I was going to say, if you want a great novel about spying, you go to World War II. You don't find anything, at least that I'm aware of, about World War One. And why not? I mean, it could be cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting question about fiction. That's actually a very good point. I can't immediately think of
anything. Yeah,
that's of any quality whatsoever. Regarding espionage that came out of World War One, I'm sure the moment we get off the air, I'll think of one.
Yeah.
But that just gets to the point. There ain't much.
Yeah.
Whereas, as you say, there's huge amounts of fiction, some of it fairly good, that comes out of World War II espionage, and a great deal that comes out of Cold War espionage.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing on this now? Do you have any plans to sort of take this farther?
Right. Well, I'm working on writing a book on this subject right now. So and I've got a proposal before an academic publisher. So come talk to me in about 3 months, and hopefully I'll have something to say. But yeah, I am working on a book on this subject. It'll be my third book, I guess, but the first one where I've really gone to this topic. So,
well, that sounds great. Again, Mark Spout discusses American espionage during World War One tonight at 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on 10th Street in downtown Kansas City. More information and to grab a seat, go to kclibrary.org. And Mark Stout, so good to have you.
My
Thanks
pleasure.
For coming
Thank
in.